This is Hacker Daily for Friday, May 18th, and today we're taking a deep dive into two stories. First, John Carmack and his interactions with Steve Jobs, and finally, getting catfished by a candidate. I'm Dave Zorub.
And I'm Harish Agarwal.
Thanks for tuning in to Hacker Daily, featuring top stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Please remember to subscribe and rate us on your podcast app.
We're going to do something a little bit different for our next piece. We are going to read a Facebook comment, really an essay that John Carmack wrote regarding his thoughts on Steve Jobs. Now, for me, I don't know about you, Dave, this is a huge meeting of minds. Steve Jobs, pretty obvious. Every startup founder in the last decade, maybe two decades, maybe three decades, wants to believe that they're Steve Jobs at some level. They want to believe that they have that kind of product acumen or can build a company like Apple for a good reason. And then there's John Carmack, who anyone who grew up in the 90s would know John Carmack either directly or via his games. He created Commander Keen, Wolfenstein, Doom, Quake, all of those great titles that you probably grew up playing if you were a child of that decade. He, of course, was the founder of id Software, which made all of those games. And it turns out that John Carmack and Steve Jobs actually interacted quite a bit, which I didn't know. Did you know that, Dave?
I didn't know it either. I definitely am a sucker for these kinds of real life Steve Jobs stories. I didn't know that he was such an interesting writer here. So this is cool for me. It's one of the first times I've actually read his stuff. I did, of course, play Commander Keen off of floppies that I bought at like a swap meet in Detroit, I think. And of course, played Wolfenstein 3D and Doom. And I got out before Quake got big. But those games certainly shaped a lot of my childhood.
Right. So let's just get into it. Rather than talk about it, we're just going to read John Carmack's Facebook comment / essay / memoir on his interactions with Steve Jobs. My wife once asked me, "Why do you drop what you are doing when Steve Jobs asks you to do something? You don't do that for anyone else." It's worth thinking about. As a teenage Apple computer fan, Jobs and Wozniak were revered figures for me, and wanting an Apple II was a defining characteristic of several years of my childhood. Later on, seeing Next at a computer show just as I was selling my first commercial software felt like a vision into the future. As id Software grew successful through Commander Keen and Wolfenstein 3D, the first major personal purchase I made wasn't a car, but rather a Next computer. It turned out to be genuinely valuable for our software development, and we moved the entire company onto Next hardware. We loved our Nexts, and we wanted to launch Doom with an explicit "developed on Next computers" logo during the startup process, but when we asked, the request was denied. Sometime after launch, when Doom had begun to make its cultural mark, we heard that Steve had changed his mind and would be happy to have Next branding on it. But that ship had sailed. I did think it was cool to trade a few emails with Steve Jobs. Several things over the years made me conclude that, at his core, Steve didn't think very highly of games, and always wished they weren't as important to his platforms as they turned out to be. I never took it personally. When Next managed to sort of reverse acquire Apple and Steve was back in charge, I was excited by the possibilities of a resurgent Apple with the virtues of Next in a mainstream platform. I was brought in to talk about the needs of games in general, but I made it my mission to get Apple to adopt OpenGL as their 3D graphics API. I had a lot of arguments with Steve. Part of his method, at least with me, was to deride contemporary options and dare me to tell him differently. They might be pragmatic, but couldn't actually be good. "I have Pixar," he'd say, "we will make something that is actually good." It was often frustrating because he could talk, with complete confidence, about things he was just plain wrong about, like the price of memory for video cards and the amount of system bandwidth exploitable by the AltEVec extensions. But when I knew what I was talking about, I would stand my ground against anyone. When Steve did make up his mind, he was decisive about it. Dictates were made, companies were acquired, keynotes were scheduled, and the reality distortion field kicked in, making everything else that was previously considered into obviously terrible ideas. I consider this one of the biggest indirect impacts on the industry that I have had. OpenGL never seriously threatened D3D on PC, but it was critical at Apple, and that meant that it remained enough of a going concern to be the clear choice when mobile devices started getting GPUs. While long in the tooth now, it was so much better than what we would have gotten if half a dozen SoC vendors rolled their own API back at the dawn of the mobile age. I wound up doing several keynotes with Steve, and it was always a crazy fire drill with not enough time to do things right, and generally requiring heroic effort from many people to make it happen at all. I tend to think this was also a calculated part of his method. My first impression of keynote Steve was him berating the poor stagehands over this Home Depot shit that was rolling out the display stand with the new Mac, very much not to his satisfaction. His complaints had a valid point, and he improved the quality of the presentation by caring about details, but I wouldn't have wanted to work for him in that capacity. One time, my wife, then fiancé, and I were meeting with Steve at Apple, and he wanted me to do a keynote that happened to be scheduled on the same day as our wedding. With a big smile and full of charm, he suggested that we postpone it. We declined, but he kept pressing. Eventually, my wife countered with the suggestion that if he really wanted her John so much, he should loan John Lasseter to her media company for a day of consulting. Steve went from full charm to ice cold really damn quick. I didn't do that keynote. When I was preparing an early technology demo of Doom 3 for a keynote in Japan, I was having a hard time dealing with some of the managers involved that were insisting that I change the demo because Steve doesn't like blood. I knew that Doom 3 wasn't to his taste, but that wasn't the point of doing the demo. I brought it to Steve with all of the relevant people on the thread. He replied to everyone with, "I trust you, John. Do whatever you think is great." That goes a long way, and nobody said a thing after that. When my wife and I later started building games for feature phones, I advocated repeatedly to Steve that an Apple phone could be really great. Every time there was a rumor that Apple might be working on a phone, I would refine the pitch to him. Once he called me at home on a Sunday to ask a question, and I enthused at length about the possibilities. I never got brought into the fold, but I was excited when the iPhone actually did see the light of day. A giant, for the time, true color display with a GPU. We could do some amazing things with this. Steve first talked about the application development for iPhone at the same keynote I was demonstrating the new id Tech 5 rendering engine on Mac, so I was in the front row. When he started going on about web apps, I was reasonably quietly going, "Boo." After the public cleared out and the rest of us were gathered in front of the stage, I started urgently going on about how web apps are terrible and wouldn't show the true potential of the device. We could do so much more with real native access. Steve responded with a line he had used before. "Bad apps could bring down cell phone towers." I hated that line. He could have just said we aren't ready and that would have been fine. I was making some guesses, but I argued that the iPhone hardware and OS provided sufficient protection for native apps. I pointed at a nearby engineer and said, "Don't you have an MMU and process isolation on the iPhone now?" He had a wide-eyed look of, "Don't bring me into this," but I eventually got a yes out of him. I said that OS X was surely being used for things that were more security critical than a phone, and if Apple couldn't provide enough security there, they had bigger problems. He came back with a snide, "You're a smart guy, John. Why don't you write a new OS?" At the time, my thought was, "Fuck you, Steve." People were backing away from us. If Steve was mad, Apple employees didn't want him to associate the sight of them with the experience. Afterwards, one of the execs assured me that Steve appreciates vigorous conversation. Still deeply disappointed about it, I made some comments that got picked up by the press. Steve didn't appreciate that. The Steve Jobs hero/shithead roller coaster was real. And after riding high for a long time, I was now on the downside. Someone told me that Steve explicitly instructed them to not give me access to the early iPhone SDK when it was finally ready. I wound up writing several successful iPhone apps on the side, and I had many strong allies inside Apple, but I was on the outs with Steve. The last iOS product I worked on was Rage for iOS, which I thought set a new bar for visual richness on mobile, and also supported some brand new features like TV out. I heard that it was well received inside Apple. I was debriefing the team after the launch when I got a call. I was busy, so I declined it. A few minutes later, someone came in and said that Steve was going to call me. Oops. Everyone had a chuckle about me hanging up on Steve Jobs, but that turned out to be my last interaction with him. As the public story of his failing health progressed, I started several emails to try to say something meaningful and positive to part on, but I never got through them and I regret it. I corroborate many of the negative character traits that he was infamous for, but elements of the path that led to where I am today were contingent on the dents he left in the universe. I showed up for him.
Our next story is called I Got Catfished by a Candidate. And there's a lot of backstory here. I'm going to try and summarize it as best I can. Basically, Dana Rothman, who's the chief revenue officer of Saster. You may have heard of them. They do conferences for software as a service businesses. They have classes. They do all kinds of events. So Dana was making a sales hire and the candidate came in. They made it through a recruiting agency. They were referred by a recruiter. They made it through a phone screen. They made it through three rounds of interviews, and Dana was about to make an offer when everything sort of unraveled. Apparently, the candidate claimed to work at a company that Dana had also worked at previously, and when Dana requested references, the candidate kind of was a little bit cagey, and so Dana went and got backdoor references, which is, you know, a fairly standard industry practice. We can talk a little bit more about that in a bit, but basically, she talked to some of her friends at the company that she used to work at, and they asked around and said, well, nobody here has ever heard of this guy. And then by coincidence, the candidate comes back with a reference listing the name of one of Dana's friends, somebody named Jim. And the reference included fake contact information, an email address and phone number that weren't Jim's phone number. Dana had just talked to Jim, and Jim had said, you know, nobody here has ever heard of this guy. So after that point, it became pretty clear that the candidate had been lying about their work history, and the company never made an offer. And Dana says that she decided not to actually confront the candidate about this, that they just kind of declined to pursue the process any further. But Dana had three lessons that she came back with, and this sparked a lot of discussion on Hacker News. So first lesson was trust your gut. She felt pretty strange that the candidate was being so cagey about the references. She also says that you should look at the candidate's social profiles and Google results. And also, always do reference checks and get a backdoor reference if you can. So, Harish, this brings up a bunch of issues. I don't know if you want to start. I mean, I guess one of the first questions I would ask is, if this person did so well in the interview, what's really the problem here?
Let me read a little bit about Dana's impressions of this candidate direct from the post. He impressed each interviewer with his knowledge and passion for the brand, his sales acumen, outbound hunter mentality, and overall presence. We talked about sales operations, discussed the pros and cons of Medic, and talked about Salesforce workflows. I mean, this guy was pretty good. So that's right from the post that Dana wrote up. It's clear that this person aced the interviews.
So what's really the problem here?
You know, there's an obvious sort of moral ethical problem here, which is, do you want to hire someone who is lying?
Right.
And will they, if they lied to get in the door, continue to lie, create an atmosphere where you can't trust them? Will that blow up in your face at some point?
And I think that's a fair question, right? But the next question is, why would the candidate lie in the first place? And I think there's a couple of potentially pretty obvious answers to that.
The thing that comes to my mind is this person absolutely aced the interviews, the in-person interviews. The question is, would he or she have even been given a chance if their real resume, their real background was known.
Exactly. So they fudged their work history in order to get in the door. But once they were in the door, they performed really well.
To me, the root of all this is sort of the root of all interviewing problems, interviewing incentive problems, where we all want to believe, and Dave and I have both been involved in hiring before, and I bet the same is true of you, Dave. I want to believe that when I am vetting a candidate, I am being completely objective, that I am evaluating them based on their merits, that the background doesn't matter. This is especially true, in my opinion, of tech hiring. We want to believe that we're hiring engineers based on their ability to code or create a product or do the right thing in a work situation, not based on where they went to school. This post is making clear that these social profiles, Google results, backdoor references, reference checks matter. What seems to be subliminal to me here is the actual background matters as well.
Yeah.
It matters where you went to school. It matters where you worked. These are all signals that we all absorb when we're looking at someone's background and we all make decisions based on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I don't know if the candidate did this intentionally. You can't know it from the post. And obviously we're not getting the candidate's side here, but did the candidate know that Dana had worked at that company and therefore put that company on the candidate's resume just to get in the door? And if they did, okay, that's definitely dishonest. And I think that we can all agree that that's probably not the most ethical decision to make. But if it got the hiring manager's attention and then they perform super well, maybe it's dishonest, but it's also kind of hacking a system.
Exactly, hacking the system. And this is a phrase that definitely earns admiration in other contexts, right? We all talk about hacking the system to achieve results, taking shortcuts. And, in other contexts, it's not always very ethical either. In this particular situation, there is obviously that risk that we talked about before of hiring someone who's fundamentally dishonest. But how do you know? How do you know that they would continue to engage in this behavior after hiring, or if they would be a model employee who exhibits the same kind of traits that you caught onto during the interview, which impressed you so much?
But I guess if it happened to me, I'd probably be wondering to myself whether they're just acting in the interview or whether this is actually a sincere expression of the candidate's abilities. Did they learn how to interview super well and that's why they interview well? Or is this actually a true expression of their abilities and they successfully hacked the system to get in the door and now they're going to perform super well?
This also goes at another common problem with interviewing, which is if an interview is hackable, what does it really tell you about a candidate?
Yeah.
Interviewing in a lot of ways is broken. We don't have interview mechanisms for the most part, which are able to give us objective information about a candidate. The thing that comes to my mind is, for better or for worse, I've always been extremely good at taking tests throughout school. I always did very well on standardized tests and the other kinds of quizzes that school throws at you. This, definitely did well for me, but I honestly don't believe that it was a true indicator of intelligence. I know plenty of people who did not do as well on those tests and did not get as far in a traditional sense on their resumes, but were able to do other very impressive things, quote unquote, outside of the system. So if those standardized tests are not really testing some sort of objective evaluation of intelligence, then the test itself is suspect, the results are suspect. It's not clear what kind of value you derive from them.
I think that's a totally fair point. And I just read this book called The Case Against Education. It's by this economist named Brian Kaplan. And he basically lays out, it's kind of a screed when it comes down to it. He has a very strongly held belief that education is essentially all about signaling. And what it signals is that you are a hard worker and that you are somewhat intelligent and that you are able to conform to the expectations put in front of you, which would make you a good corporate worker. And I think that there are parallels to the interview system that's been set up. We've both talked about this, I think, on the show in the past, but the traditional engineering interview for a software engineer these days involves putting a candidate through a gamut of questions, a lot of which don't have a ton of bearing on the day-to-day of a software engineer's work. Most of the work that at least I've ended up doing, and I'm sure you, Harish, as well, when you're running your own startup or doing even working at a somewhat large startup is very unglamorous work, mostly about making web forms and making sure the data gets saved right and that you're not kind of screwing any of that stuff up, which is not about algorithmic knowledge and math and crazy things. It's really about, okay, does the form post to this endpoint properly? And somehow interviews are not about that at all. They're about this algorithmic knowledge, a lot of the stuff that you learn in school if you study computer science. And when I've said to people, hey, this is weird, like the questions we're asking don't actually reflect the work that we're doing, the response is, well, people should know what the interview is because this is how companies interview. And if you don't know that, you're not able to practice enough to perform well on this kind of test, then that's a negative signal in and of itself, which I find pretty strange.
To me, it seems as if the folks who already got through the gauntlet, got through the interview, are creating justifications for why that gauntlet is valid. You want to believe that you passed some objective measure of quality of intelligence vetting, and you don't want to leave the gate open to anyone else who may not pass that same objective, quote unquote, objective measure of quality or intelligence.
I agree. There's definitely some kind of, I did this, so now you have to do this. I don't want to say hazing, so that's probably a little bit too strong, but it feels like that. Well, I had to go through this to get my job, and now I'm on the other side of the table, so I'm going to do the same thing to you that they did to me, kind of thing.
To bring it back to this catfish story, the thing that strikes me here is, let's play out an imaginary scenario where this person had not been caught and had been hired, and let's just say, for the sake of argument, had done extremely well. Now, let's fast forward 5 years, 10 years. Maybe this person has kept advancing through the ranks because he was able to break through. And maybe he's in a much better position now than he was before. The question that comes to mind is this already happening? Has this happened before?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And in prep for this, I was Googling around to try to find cases of this. And most of the cases that I found are really about people not fudging their previous work experience, but fudging their educational experience. A lot of people attended college but didn't complete a degree, or started grad school but didn't finish. And some, I'll just give a few prominent examples. So David Geffen, who started Geffen Records, is like a Hollywood mogul, is responsible for lots of popular music over the years. When he first was getting started in Hollywood, he lied about attending and graduating from UCLA so he could get a job at a talent agency. And, you know, when he was interviewed about this much later, he said, look, I'm not setting an example. It's an idiotic thing that you have to be a college graduate to be an agent. Did I have a problem with lying to get the job? None whatsoever. Right. So he's unrepentant about it. And obviously, he's been incredibly successful. I think he's a billionaire. So maybe there's some correlation here between breaking the rules in one way and breaking the rules in order to be successful in another way. Some other prominent examples, Scott Thompson, who was CEO of Yahoo very briefly, and the former president of PayPal. He was named as Yahoo CEO in January 2012, and his resume said that he had degrees in both accounting and computer science from Stonehill College. An activist investor did some research into his background and found that he actually only had a degree in accounting, and he was forced to resign from his position there. This is also true of the former CEO of Radio Shack, who worked there for over a decade, rose up in the ranks. And after he became CEO, it was reported in a newspaper in Texas that he didn't actually graduate. And so in that case, the Radio Shack board actually stood up for him and said, hey, you can stay on in your job. But Edmondson actually decided to resign on his own. So it's clear that this happens, that people are fudging, probably to get in the door in the first place, and that a lot of these people end up being pretty successful. But when they're found out, most of them end up having to resign. I find it's a little strange that they're so successful that you give them the CEO job, but 20 years ago, they didn't actually finish their CS degree, so now they're not qualified anymore.
The thing that I have a hard time keeping in mind about these stories, which I think is super important, these folks didn't lie to get the CEO job. They earned that. They lied to get their foot in the door 20 years ago. When I read these stories, I sometimes feel this sense of outrage that these folks were deceiving everyone for, you know, decades to get to this position, but that's not the case. There was one lie in the beginning, obviously very objectionable from a moral, ethical point of view, but it got them that first job. It didn't get them the next job or the next job or the CEO job. They earned that. They earned their way up the ranks, demonstrating value.
My first tech job was at Microsoft. I went straight out of college, went through the classic interview gamut. I talked about this on the show previously. I only stayed there for a year. It wasn't actually an amazing fit for me, but having that on my resume when I ended up moving to the Bay Area and interviewing at startups, it got me in the door. And I wasn't lying about it, but there wasn't anything about my experience at Microsoft that would have necessarily said, oh, I'm going to be great at working. I'm great at working at a 40,000 person huge enterprise. I'm going to be awesome at working at your 6-person startup. There's not a ton of overlap there. So when we've both hired a fair number of people ourselves, right?
Yeah, I was involved in hiring at my first startup, Octopart, and it was a process to learn how to hire correctly, to be honest, I don't believe I know how to hire correctly still, but to improve hiring, to get good results, to be happy with the team that we were building. It was a process. When we started, we made all of these common mistakes, made all sorts of biased decisions, not on purpose, but by making these common mistakes, which we're evaluating folks based on a very, very subjective scale, based on our own experience or how we like to work. I would like to believe that we got better, but we definitely kept making mistakes. And I would be absolutely lying if I said that we didn't pay attention to what was on someone's resume before we hired them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess one question might be, is there any solution here?
Well, there are a number of folks who are trying to work on solutions here, trying to pick apart the interviewing process, trying to understand what is valuable, what's going to demonstrate on the job success versus just demonstrating interviewing success. It seems like a hard nut to crack, right? The fundamental problem to me is you'll always have a much shorter amount of time with a candidate in the interviewing process than you'll have with them when they're on the job. And you don't learn everything during that short amount of time on the interview process. You learn everything when they're on the job.
And that's why there's a lot of companies that are trying to at least remove some of the bias from the process. There's TripleByte trying to do a centralized interview process where they're supposedly vetting these candidates deeply for you. A-List from AngelList also does this. Interviewing.io is an anonymous interview platform where you don't know who the other person is on the other side. Hopefully that helps remove the bias, but it's still, to your point, you don't actually know how good someone is until you've worked with them. So maybe there is no long-term solution to this. Maybe we're all just going to be fumbling towards trying to make better, unbiased decisions. But ultimately, to me, it kind of reminds me of working on a dating site. When I worked at hotornot.com back in the day, it was like Tinder. People would match with each other and then go on a date. Ultimately, it's one thing to think somebody has a good profile or, you know, is good at chatting. As soon as you actually meet them and you spend time with them, that's a very different thing than looking at a resume, for example, or putting somebody through a couple of coding exercises. It's very different to sit next to them and work with them on something that actually matters.
The best interview really is the first few months after the hire, not the interview itself.
That's all for Hacker Daily this week. Thanks so much for tuning in, for giving us a shot in this new format. We'd love to hear your feedback. Please reach out to us via email at info@hackerdaily.co. Or you can follow us on Twitter or DM us. Our handle is HackerDaily. And we'll be back next week with more stories for hackers, founders, and makers. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.